are ideal for every member of your family, especially the young ones in college. Unlike other water filtration systems, Berkey purifiers are portable. They require no plumbing, and the elements don't have to be replaced every 4 to 6 months. Perfect for anyone on a tight budget, and more importantly, if there's an unexpected emergency, your loved ones will be prepared. That's because Berkey systems are able to purify raw, untreated water. Check out our Christmas specials at Berkey Water.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joyce Riley from the Power Hour, and we're going to talk about the things that she's interested in because, of course, she has a parallel program on Genesis and certainly has all sorts of interesting subjects. Joyce, how are you today?
Well, hi, Dr. Stan. I'm just really fine. Thank you very much.
Why don't you tell us the things that you think are really important that you'd like to talk about today?
Well, what I'd like to talk about is some of the material that the U.S. military has written in the past that they are using to predict the future. In other words, of course, you're familiar with the Army War College. Have you spent a lot of time with your listeners on the revolution in military affairs and conflict short of war?
I really haven't. You know, many years ago we talked about it. We haven't talked about it in a long time. We'd love to hear what your thoughts.
I got a phone call from the BBC the other night asking me if I would come on their program for their City Talk program. And City Talk is a big, big program in the UK. And whenever BBC asks you to come on, you know, of course I wonder what is their motivation or why do they want me to speak. And I know Dave Von Kleist has been on there many times talking about 9/11, and they're very interested. I mean, the UK is very interested in what he has to say on 9/11. However, they wanted me to come on, and when I asked Roy, the host of the program, what it was he wanted me to talk about, it was about how we got into the Gulf War in the first place. And I thought that was very strange and very surprising, given the fact that there's so much to talk about with the phony wars that exist today. What could we possibly want to go back to that time period for? And his response is that it appears now that people are really starting to question everything. And so now going back even to 1990 and 1985 and saying, how did we get in this mess in the first place? People are having even more realizations that, oh my gosh, this has been a total fraud. Now I know that you know and your listeners know how we got into that war in 1990. And know that, and many of them were very young at that time and probably didn't think a whole lot about the motivation for the war. But of course the United States wanted us in the war, and we had done the build-up for that war for many, many years. Arms sales are huge, and I'm talking about military arms sales are one of the biggest things that this country does to support itself. So we have to sell to foreign countries, number one, to make friends, and number two, to be able to survive, and our military defense contractors are evidence of that. And back in the 1980s, of course, in 1983, we know about the famous trip to Iraq with Donald Rumsfeld visiting Saddam Hussein. He had been basically our enemy before that, and he was our enemy after that. Then in 1987, in the war with Halabja, the United States was assisting them in that operation, and it was called Operation Nimble Archer. So the United States is selling all these weapons during the time frame in the 1980s through 1990 and possibly 1991 to our enemies, and then we decide that, oh my goodness, he is a good guy in 1983, and we can sell him biological weapons, we can sell him weapons of mass destruction, we can sell him whatever he wants because now he's a good guy. Well, he wasn't a good guy, necessarily. He was probably our guy. He was either a bad guy or a good guy, whichever guy we wanted to make him at the time. And, of course, we all know what happened at that from that point on. But in the 1980s, in the war with Halabja, or Iran-Iraq war, the U.S. gave them or sold them the Bell helicopters, then adjusted the nozzles on them, showed them how to spray the gas.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Joyce Riley of the Power Hour. And Joyce is talking about the background of the our relationship with Iraq and how, of course, we were backing Iraq all during the Iraq-Iran war. And then, of course, we were selling them the helicopters with the equipment to use it to spray poison gas and all sorts of other things. But you pick up the story there. Now, we have some new listeners, so if you want to be a little repetitive, you go right ahead.
Well, I think it's important to understand where we came from, because all of this bears tremendous importance on where we are right now. This war with Iraq, or Iraq and Iran war, was really a war that the United States wanted to be on the side of the winner. In other words, we weren't really concerned, I think, at that time, whether Iran or Iraq won. We just wanted to make sure we were selling them both weapons and that we were friends to whichever country came out on top. So we gave the helicopters and under the Operation Nimble Archer, our special forces directed Saddam Hussein's troops on how to utilize them and how to spray his own people with gas. And, of course, that's the main reason that, we had him put to death was because he killed his own people. And as if the United States has never done that or never experimented on their own people. But at that time, though, we were selling through Matrix Churchill, we were arming Iraq as well as the other Middle Eastern countries as fast as we could. And the book Spider's Web is an awesome book. It has been taken off the market. It was taken off the market, in fact, 2 weeks after it came out back in 1992, I believe, or 1993, because of the fact that it was, quote unquote, not selling well. Now, that's what the stores told me at the time when I found out about it. And it was written by an editor or a writer for the Financial Times of London. Friedman is his name, wrote the book called Spider's Web. And in it, it shows that the U.S. was complicit and promoted, along with George Bush Sr., the sale of these biologicals, the weapons to Iraq. In fact, James Defense Weekly, I got the reports from 87 through 91. And back in 87, 88, and 89, we tripled our sales of weapons. Now, this is before the war, because remember, the war was started on August 2nd of 1990. But we tripled our sale of weapons to Iraq and all the other countries during that time. So we tripled our sale of weapons 3 years before the war started. So we knew we were going to go to war somehow, some way. It didn't matter how the war started. We just wanted it to start.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joyce Riley, and we're talking really about, of course, the tragedy of what happened in Iraq. What most people don't understand is that the United States was funding Saddam Hussein. We have a wonderful article we sent out to anybody who asked for it. It came out in the Washington Post. The title is When an Ally Becomes an Enemy, and it goes into the background that we gave Saddam Hussein $5 billion under one guise or another, you know, so that he could buy the weapons that he used then to kill the Iranians, that the weapons that he could use to kill his own people. Why would we do that? Well, we have people in government, the highest level of government, who have a different sense of morality. And, of course, during the Iraq-Iran war, we were selling weapons to Iran. We were selling weapons to Iraq. But in with Iraq, we were actually funding Iraq so they could could buy the weapons, the Iranians had to pay for them themselves. But so Joyce is simply going into the background of that we were actually increasing the armaments to Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War, because of course we knew we were going to go to war. And the oldest trick in the world, whether it happened in the Second World War, when of course we actually helped to fund Adolf Hitler and helped to build up his military before the war. If you want to read about it, Charles Hingham's book, Trading with the Enemy, Professor Sutton's book, which we do carry, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And then, of course, we did the same thing during the Vietnam War. We were funding Russia, that was funding the North Vietnamese, that was funding the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. We did doing the same thing in Afghanistan today, where we're funding the Pakistani, we're funding their ISI that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys in Afghanistan. You pick up the story there, Joyce.
And I think a lot of people may say, well, that's history. Why is that so important? Because I'm going to get to the point of the atrocities, which we do need to keep reminding ourselves about. And then we've got a latest paper. I'm going to go through the atrocity that started the war in just a second. And then I want to talk about the revolution in military affairs and conflict short of war, because this is so specific to what's happening right now. And then the new paper, I don't know if you're familiar with this one, Dr. Stan. Have you heard of the new paper called Known Unknowns?
No, I really don't know that. That's why I love to get you on, Joyce, because you're always way ahead of me on a lot of these things. Go right ahead.
Well, I appreciate that. I just didn't want to cover it if you had covered it, but
no,
I'm going to get to the paper called... Now, this is the latest from the Army War College and Strategic Studies Institute, called Known Unknowns. What does that remind you of, right? Donald Rumsfeld. And it's called Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development. And in here, it tells that we are going to be hit. And I am going to go, I was absolutely astounded when I read this. But going back to 1987, the war is going on, Iraq, Iran, Halabja. We are setting up Iraq. We are arming him. We're giving him weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons. We are giving him, along with Russia and the UK, whatever he needs. We are setting him up with all the weapons that we know that the U.S. would like to test against. So now we come out with the Tri-Service Vaccine Task Force and their desire to want to experiment during the Gulf War with vaccines such as West Nile Fever Virus or bubonic plague or whatever. And lo and behold, many of these things, or I think it was Clostridium difficile, I'm not sure, or botulinum. And then we find out that the U.S. government had sold those agents to Iraq and then decided, oh, we'll have a vaccine program against it. In other words, what it appears to me to be is setting our troops up to be either annihilated or experimented upon by these horrendous bacteriological agents. Now, why would we do this? Well, because our military has always been a testing ground. Why would we send our military in with 800,000 defective chemical suits? Now, this is really unbelievable, because people who have served in the military, like myself, believe the military could do no wrong. They care about us. They're so careful. They want us to get all of our vaccinations on time. They want us to be so healthy. They give us physicals. They make sure of our equipment is in working order. And then why would they purchase 850,000 defective chemical suits? People say that can't be. Well, the information is really fast disappearing on the website, but if you're interested and you want to look at this and you can't believe that I'm telling you this, that this is true, Google Isratex, I-S-R-A-T-E-X, an Israeli company that sold 850,000 defective suits. The U.S. government knew they were defective. They don't not test their equipment. They stress test everything. So they got it, they found out they were defective, and they sent our troops off to war with these defective suits. Now, after the war, there was a lawsuit against Isratex, but Isratex was able to beat that. They left, they were gone, and as a result of that, they never faced any prosecutions. So, and by the way, Isratex was located in Raynell, West Virginia. And how tragic it is that these troops were all going into battle thinking, oh, my suit will save me, my mask will save me. And as we've talked to Dr. Doug Rocky, there was no way that any of those things could have saved us or them or anyone, because they were all defective and they were not fine enough to be able to filter out the chemical and biological agents. So as a result, we now know that we have hundreds of thousands of our military that are now sick. Well, all of this, you know, was in place to start this war. And, of course, we know the story of April Glaspie, who was ambassador to Iraq, who said to Saddam Hussein, or to his people, basically, we have no opinion on the war. If you're going to go to war with Kuwait, well, that's all your business. And, I mean, that's a translation of what she said. So, essentially, we go, we watch Saddam go off to war with Kuwait, invade Kuwait, and then we say, oh my goodness, he's invaded Kuwait. Now we've got to go in there and we've got to stop this. And we have to right the situation in Kuwait and free the people of Kuwait. And the people of Kuwait have never been free before. It was never a free country. But of course, we had our own motivation to get in there. Now there are a lot of people that have said that U.S. wanted this war with Iraq regardless. And it appears now it was obviously set up and it was a created situation. And I happen to even question at this point whether Saddam Hussein was ever hung. I think that whole story about taking a cell phone in there, somebody snuck a cell phone into the hanging and took pictures. Well, it sounds a little weak to me, but it's like many of the stories that we hear, the, oh, we are so stupid stories. Well, interestingly enough, the war didn't get off to a really good start because the U.S. wasn't, the people in the U.S. were not really too concerned about this country, Iraq, and what they were doing in Kuwait, and certainly not wanting to spend the lives of our men and women over there. Little did we know we would spend generation after generation. So that's where we hear the story of Nayira, and we mustn't ever forget about this incredible, fraudulent story of Nayira, because the Hillary Clinton, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, because this young girl, Nayira, 15 years of age, supposedly was a volunteer in the hospital in Kuwait, and she watched the Republican Guard throw the babies out of the incubators onto the cold floor where they died. They were stabbing the babies with their guns. And this was the story that we all saw. That, Dr. Stan, is what motivated me to go back as an inactive reservist and say, that does it. I'm going to sign up here at Kelly Air Force Base again. Send me over. I've had it. I cannot stand to see about these little babies being bayoneted.
I think it's important for our listeners to remember that this was actually testimony, congressional testimony, by a weeping girl who gave this story. But, of course, it was all a lie. She was the daughter of the Kuwait ambassador. She hadn't been in Kuwait. It was all carefully staged to engender an emotional response from the American people, just like the stories that got us into the First World War of the Huns cutting off the hands of the little Belgian boys and the breasts of the Belgian women and raping them. And we had to have these atrocity stories of the Japanese, how terrible they are, just like we have to have our stories today of how terrible the Muslims are because they want us to hate the Muslims. Because they want us to go to war with the Muslim world. That's the next step. But you go right ahead, Joyce.
Well, and I'm glad you said that. And that is so important to remember this. And that's why I'm bringing all of this up. Because on the BBC, I wanted to remind everybody that when they hear about these atrocities, don't just take for granted that you're being told the truth. Start questioning them. Because I believe that Nayira story. And that's the reason that I think I got my ox gored, my personal ox gored, and I took 10 vaccines in one day. And I became quite ill as a result of that, though I did not deploy. And I'm really grateful. At the time, I felt cheated. I wanted to deploy. I wanted to go to Iraq or Kuwait. And I wasn't sent over there because the war came to a screeching halt the week I was supposed to deploy. But now I look back, I'm glad that I did not deploy. And Yahweh God has a reason for everything, obviously. And I didn't deploy, and I know now that as a result of my not deploying, I could say that my disease that I got as a result of the military was in the vaccines. I knew because I didn't have the chemicals or the biologicals. I had instead 10 vaccines that made me sick, which began my, you know, my work with Dr. Help me out here. Dr. at MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Garth Nicholson.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, to find out what had caused all of this. Well, this story of Nayira is what motivated me. I doubt I would have gone back to Kelly Air Force Base had it not been for that story. The story worked. It worked for many people. And that's why these atrocities, and George Bush, Sr., talked about the Nayira story 5 different times. Now, that story came to you from Hill & Knowlton Advertising Agency. They were paid over $1 million a month to create a phony story and get people so sympathetic. And I resent this to this day of how many people's lives have been affected because of a fraud. The lady who was in charge of this then went to work for the Commerce Department afterwards. I'm talking about the one that created that story for Hill & Knowlton. She was vice president of Hill & Knowlton Advertising Agency at the time. So this is one of the biggest frauds in history that you don't hear a word about except on shows like this. That motivated people into a war. Then we get into the fact that people still weren't behind the war, even though this story motivated a lot of people. It didn't really get them into the war because America still couldn't stand the idea of sending our people over there to fight their battle. So then
We'll be back in just a moment with Joyce Roddy. Go right ahead, Joyce.
Then we have the oil well fire story. And that story, I believe, is as much of a fraud, though we have not been able to track that one down as much. I will tell you that I had three different people over a period of 5 years that came to me. One was from Naval Special Forces, one was from Army Special Forces, and I forget what the other one was from. But they were all involved, they said, in the operation of igniting the oil well fires. Now, they didn't have a name for it, or I could not track down the name to this operation. But each of them told me how they had started the oil well fires over in Iraq to try and get the sympathy of the American public. Well, think what those oil well fires did to our men. It destroyed their lungs. It destroyed their respiratory system, many of them. And it was done to create the desire to show that Saddam was a bad guy. He would light his own oil wells on fire. And they told me how they were given the mission under a UN commander to go in and how they did it. Each one of them, I had them walk me through the story of how they set those on fire. They were all in separate contingencies that were sent out in groups of either one to three people, and they all told the same story, and they didn't know each other. So I knew then there had to be something behind this. Then I found out that the United Nations had held hearings up through 2002 that I could see, in which Iraq said, we didn't start those fires. And I actually got the proceedings from the UN hearings that were held, in which Iraq was contesting having to pay the damages for those oil wells, that they had never done it and that they had been set by someone else. So here we have a lot of people now being damaged. The people of Iraq, the military people from the UK, the US, from Australia, from all the quote-unquote coalition countries, which we actually did have in the first Gulf War. We don't now because everybody's pulled out and said, you're on your own, United States. But we did during the first Gulf War. Now, lo and behold, during this time, though, after the Gulf War, and we don't need to revisit what happened as a result of the Gulf War, but of course they didn't want to kill Saddam Hussein. Many of the snipers that I talked to had been given the orders to stand down. Don't kill Saddam Hussein. Now, wait a minute. If he was that big of a bad guy, his men threw babies out of incubators, they lit the oil wells on fire, then why wouldn't we want to kill him? Well, we needed him for later on. And they weren't quite ready for doing what they needed to do later on. Now, of course, they were never really ready because they never even had an exit strategy because they forgot about that. And, of course, no military is going to forget about that. That is if they really want to exit from a war. But, you know, even the military will tell us now, the only thing we've taken is 60% of Baghdad, basically, in Iraq. And yet, we've been there how many years? Now, we know we could have fought and won the war had that been our goal. But it's not the goal to win the war and walk away. It's the goal to win the, it's to play war for the next umpteen years and to have the 20-some military bases that we have there. So, of course, the idea of, well, are we going to pull troops out or are we not? We know they're not. They're building up all the time. Or they play the shift going from Iraq to Afghanistan and back to Iraac again. Well, in 1994, the Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War was written.
All right, hold that thought, Joyce. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joyce Roddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joyce has simply been talking to us a little bit about the fact that we never really tried to win the war over in Iraq, certainly not the first time around. We certainly, if Iraq, find me, if Saddam Hussein was such a terrible guy in 1991, why didn't we go after him? They had all sorts of excuses. Well, there's a wonderful book written by Bob Woodward. It's called Shadow, Five Presidents, The Legacy of Watergate by Bob Woodward. And in that book, and I'll be glad to provide the pages for any of our listeners, Wife Chris tells about a conference held in the Oval Office, and Colin Powell was there, Brent Scowcroft, James Baker, and George Herbert Walker Bush. And Baker and Colin Powell wanted to negotiate, tell Saddam Hussein, you get your troops out of Kuwait or we're going to come after you. And Scowcroft and Bush didn't want to do it. And Baker said, look, I'll just go over there and we'll sit down with Saddam Hussein and tell him what's going to happen to him if he doesn't do this. And Bush said, no, you can't go. We have to have this war. We have to have this war. You're never going to hear that mentioned any place. People think that, you know, we went in because of the terrible atrocities. No, they're on some sort of a timetable. They certainly schedule the first Gulf War, now the second Gulf War, and there's another war that's coming, I fear, very, very soon in that area. Everything is being done to build up the nuclear potential of the Muslim world in preparation for the coming war, and if you doubt that, please go to RadioLiberty.com and pull down my January 2008 newsletter entitled State Secrets, It's the Story of Sybil Edmonds. And the story she tried to get out and was blocked by the media, and even when she went to the London Times, and her story was published all over Europe about how our State Department was involved with transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan and the Muslim world, totally blacked out in America. But go ahead, pick up the story there, Joyce.
I think it's so important to realize that the Muslims have been picked as a group to create as the bad guy right now, the villain. And I feel so sorry for many of them who are innocent. Now, maybe not, I mean, they don't agree with us, obviously, in our religions, but then that's no reason to make them out to be the horrible boogeymen that they are. But we always have to have the boogeymen. We have to have that. You know, when I read The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, now, if you would like to see a copy of this, you can go to the Internet, go to GulfWarVets.com, and we have it there so you can download the entire paper. It's, about 35, 40 pages. But it will change your life once you read this. And let me give you an idea of how bad this is. It talks about, in this environment, of why we would have a revolution in military affairs. It says, U.S. objectives will increasingly be symbolic as we pursue humanitarian relief or attempt to cultivate a system of world order. And then they talk about the third world is going to be full of danger. Let's slip the dogs of war using emerging technology. They talk about the revolution military affairs will require the use of a chip. They call it an IPLD. They actually, in here on page 7, you go to it and check it out yourself. Mark down these pages so you can see it. In the future, Americans will be at risk, and this device, an IPLD, will be permanently implanted under the skin with automatic remote activation, either upon departure from the U.S. territory or whatever, basically at an airport. An implantation would help preclude the removal of the device. I'm reading right from a military document, U.S. Army War College document. The IPLD, the Individual Position Locator Device, could act as a form of identification. It will identify you as, or an individual as, friend, foe, or neutral. Now think about this. This was 1994. They don't write these things as if it's for a video game or some kind of entertainment for the military. They talk about electromagnetic pulse transformer bombs. They talk about of these being used for counter narco-trafficking. Now, if you remember, we've been hearing a lot about the border of Mexico and narco-trafficking. Now, all of this in here is to be used to stop the narco-traffickers, well, or for whatever reason they decide to use it for at the time. Now they talk about the use of a weapon designed to target only a specific racial or ethnic group. And they say that most Americans would not support the use of a weapon designed to target only a specific racial or ethnic group in anything less than a war for survival of this nation.
Well, I guess that war is going to be here before very long, ladies and gentlemen, if it really is.
And it asks a question.
We'll go right ahead, Joyce.
And then it asks the question, and again, I'm going to give you the full title, The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, U.S. Army War College, 1994. And again, it's at GulfWarVets.com. You check it out yourself. And then it asks the question, could the government and military of this multi-ethnic republic face charges that it was developing or using a weapon targeting Africans, Jews, Koreans, Hispanics, etc.? I mean, it always asks a question. But the very fact that they would even address that is beyond belief. I mean, I could not imagine that I was reading what I was reading in here when I saw this. Then, attached to this, in the document that we have, and we do have it at the Power Hour, it's a bound document, but there's a document called the Special Warfare, Professional Bulletin of the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School. Now, this one happens to be dated, well, it's Volume 9, Number 2, May of 1996. And it states, and it talks about, we examine the future revolutions in military affairs. And they state, other countries in what was once called the Third World will almost certainly suffer a horrid fate in coming years, sinking into a condition of degradation almost too awful to imagine. Now, how did they know this, if this was not planned? Is this going to be the bird flu? Is this going to be no food? What is it going to be? Now, listen to this. This is in the Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict in the 21st Century, which is that Special Warfare Bulletin that I just mentioned. It states, our grandchildren and great-grandchildren may live in a far happier world thanks to the anticipated mid-21st century easing of democratic pressures and to the continued advances of technology. But the next several decades are likely to witness human misery on a scale unprecedented in history. Famine, pestilence, and death. Three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse probably will ravage hundreds of millions, perhaps billions, of human beings, and the fourth horseman is war. They go on to state, and again, this was written in 1996.
No, I'm sorry. Are you quoting now from the Revolution and Conflict?
No, this is a Special Warfare Professional Bulletin of John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center.
Go right ahead.
And it is, we include it with the at the Power Hour. We include it with the Revolution Military Affairs, but I think it's online at GulfWarVets.com. But they state, food and water shortages may prompt desperate invasions by people seeking escape from hunger and thirst.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joyce has certainly been reading to us from something that comes out of one of the centers where they actually study military warfare, talking about, and of course this is written in the mid-1990s, 1995, 1996, about how the coming years are going to be horrible, horrible times of horrible deprivation and famine and warfare and death and pestilence and disease. And then after that, maybe by the middle of the 21st century, things will start getting better. You see, these people plan these things. These things don't happen by the acts of themselves. Plagues, you know, we like to think they're acts of God, but sometimes they're the acts of men. Wars are planned long ahead of time, and then all you have to do is come up with an excuse to get the people to go along with the wars. And you say, well, nobody would do anything like that. And I would like to suggest that's exactly what they do. If you study the background of the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the First Gulf War, the Second Gulf War, and so much of what's going on in Africa today, even the battle between the Palestinians and Hamas, the terrorists. Of course, actually, we are subsidizing Egypt. All the weapons have to be brought through Egypt to get to Hamas so they can use them to kill the Israelis. So why don't we just say to the Egyptians, you stop this foolishness or we're going to stop financing you? Why? Because we don't want to. It's all staged, ladies and gentlemen. Before we go on, Joyce, I want you to get out your webpage, let people know how they can get in touch with your material and hear your radio program.
Well, go to thepowerhour.com, and you can find there how to listen to the program, listen live, and listen on our incredible Global Star, thanks to Dr. Stan. And we appreciate so much being on Global Star Network. But go to thepowerhour.com. Also, check out GulfWarVets.com for the documents that we've got on that website also.
All right, well, you pick up and go ahead with the material you were talking about. You were talking about this information, this booklet that comes out from, is that the John F. Kennedy School on Warfare?
That's correct, John F. Kennedy School on Special Warfare. It's been says, and they predict this, and almost tell you the timeline, like you just said, mid-21st century easing. By the mid-21st century, there will be easing of demographic pressures. Well, what that means is there's going to be a whole lot less population to have to deal with. They're telling you that. And then they say that food and water shortages may prompt desperate invasions by people seeking escape from hunger and thirst. Deadly plagues may prompt mass flight across even well-guarded borders. Crime may appeal to many as the only relief from poverty. Anyway, they go on and talking about huge riots, toppling of governments. It gets to be really depressive, talking about the massive illegal immigration that's going to take place. And it is really a horrible situation they outline there. Now, you would think, and then they go into Muslim resentment and how much Muslim resentment there is going to be. Now, this was 1994. Now, why are they talking about the severe, it says already, for psychologically and historically understandable reasons, the imbalance of wealth has created severe Muslim resentment toward Christians in the West. And they talk about how this is going to be continued and the psychological operations. So it's right there. Then, unfortunately, they go into the urban warfare, which is what we're seeing right now. The urban warfare and the new burdens of urban warfare in the United States. Well, that brings us up to just a little while ago, last year, in November of 2008, I got a copy of what I consider to be the latest little bombshell in documents coming out from Strategic Studies Institute or the U.S. Army War College. That is the one that appeared in November 2008, and it is entitled Known Unknowns. Now, remember that statement that Donald Rumsfeld gave? You know, there's known unknowns and unknown knowns, and, you know, it made no sense whatsoever, at least to those of us who are listening to him. But obviously it made sense to the military. Well, they titled their document, which is about another 40 pages long, Known Unknowns, the Unconventional Strategic Shocks in Defense Strategy Development. Now, this is a really easy read, but it's really depressing. And it talks about the unconventional strategic shocks that are going to take place. It's a clear warning against excessive adherence to past defense and national security conventions and says that we are going to experience wild cards and strategic surprise. The future disruptive unconventional shocks are inevitable. So here we go with continuing to tell us what's going to take place. Though strategic impact and potential for disruption and violence, defense-relevant unconventional shocks, in spite of their non-military character, will demand the focused attention of the Defense Department. Then we go to the statement, and by the way, this is written by Nathan Freer, who is a visiting professor of the U.S. Army's Peacekeeping and Stability Operations, and he says, the current defense team, now he was talking, of course, in 2008 about the Bush defense team, The current defense team confronted a game-changing strategic shock in its first 8 months in office. We all know that to be 9/11. Now listen what they say. The next team, being, of course, Obama's people and Gates at the Department of Defense, the next team would be well advised to expect the same. Defense-relevant strategic shocks jolt convention to such an extent that they will force sudden, unanticipated change in the Department of Defense's perceptions about threat, vulnerability, and strategic response. The likeliest and most dangerous future shocks will be unconventional. They will be non-military in origin. Now, how do they know all this? That is so frightening to me that they can almost tell us to the date that this is going to happen. Now, they say, right there in the summary of this, that the Bush team confronted a game-changing strategic shock in its first 8 months in office, and then they say the next team, or Obama's team, would be well-advised to expect the same. Now, what do you think they're saying right there? In my estimation, they are telling the world, or the people that have access to this document, it's going to happen within the first 8 months of Obama being in office. Would you agree with that, Dr. Stan?
Well, you have to wait and see, but I believe we're in some very, very difficult times when we have a new president who's talking about a civilian police force. That sounds like the brown shirts in Germany. And night after night during my dinner time, we hear this program over and over again. It's about a minute or 2 minute ad, talking about how we have to all get involved, you know, with planning and rebuilding America, and we want to volunteer. Well, they want compulsory volunteering. They're going to force people to go into public service. And, of course, they're setting up a system of informants across America. People say it couldn't happen here, and I would say it not only could, it is happening here. You never know when your best friend may very well be a government informant, and they're keeping dossiers on us, and they're putting up video cameras every place, and they want everybody to have a driver's license with a radioactive chip in it, or a RFID chip in it, so they can track every single individual. They already have the ability to listen to our radio, to our telephone calls through something known as Project Echelon. You will never see this discussed in the media, but it's there. You go up on the internet, look it up, where they actually have brought Britishers over here, Englishmen over here, to listen through computers to all the telephone calls and monitor all the faxes and all the emails, not just on terrorists. They're tracking every American citizen. They're establishing dossiers on it. People say, well, that just sounds paranoid. No, you're only paranoid when you imagine people are against you. There really are people there who have a different world view. They really want a fascist society and to use our military and the financial power to bring about this world order. Would you go ahead, Joyce?
Well, and of course we know that recently the state of Missouri has put out this document about the be careful, be aware of these people. And we're talking about these people, the ones that have Ron Paul bumper stickers. The people that talk about tax issues, you know, they've got this whole list of things.
Oh, if you talk about the Constitution, obviously you're a potential terrorist. If you adhere to the Constitution, what a terrible thing. You're to be true. You're to go along with the government. Don't worry about the Constitution. The government knows what's best for you from the cradle to the grave, and we're going to provide it. We're going to provide for your health care. We're going to provide for your energy. We're going to provide for your education. We're going to provide for everything that you need. Don't you worry. We're going to take care of you. Go ahead.
And of course, all we have to do is look at how the military is taken care of to see how they are going to take care of us. But back to this release of this report in the state of Missouri, in which the governor and the head of the Highway Patrol put out this document stating all the things that you need to be aware of, and most people have heard about it by now, the MIAC document, is that they are going to be looking at and profiling individuals. Now, we had Judge Napolitano from Fox News on the program this morning for just a few minutes because he's going to be in St. Louis this weekend talking about this very issue with Ron Paul. So a group of us are going up there to see him on Friday night. Judge Napolitano is going to be discussing how illegal this is in the state of Missouri to be doing this. Now, they're coming there for the Campaign for Liberty program, and it was already scheduled before this happened. But this is going to be perfect timing because we're going to find out what we can do in the state of Missouri, and everybody else hopefully is going to be paying attention because this is not going to be just the state of Missouri that's going to be involved in this. But he said this is horribly illegal. There is no way that they can do that. That is profiling.
But, of course, they've been collecting dossiers on us for years. I've seen my FBI file 20 years ago. They had clippings of every talk I'd given at any time, anywhere in the country. They had a dossier on me 20 years ago. I'm sure they got a wonderful one on you, Joyce. But don't think it's just because we're prominent. They collect dossiers on every citizen. Every time you buy anything with a credit card or with a grocery card, of records are being kept. They've gone around to the Department of Motor Vehicles all across the country and gotten your picture. It's there someplace. Now they're going to put your medical records up on the Internet so they'll have your picture and your medical records. And did you hear Barack Obama saying, we want to preserve your privacy, and so we're going to put your medical records up on the Internet? And most people sort of scratch their head and say, how can you maintain my privacy and put my medical records on the Internet? But I guess I shouldn't question. They know more than I do. And that's the trouble. They do know more than you do. And you better be concerned because there are people who do not believe in privacy. We know that the Defense Department has been keeping dossiers on American citizens. You want to check that out. The book written in 2003 by the former head of the NSA, the most secret of all spy agencies, Lieutenant General William Odom. He can't tell us what's going on because he'd be put in prison, but he could ask questions. And one of the questions was, should the Defense Department be keeping dossiers on American citizens? That's all he could say. Should they be keeping them? Well, I think you pretty well know that they are. Go right ahead.
Well, I just think that that fits perfectly into this Army War College statement of tagging people as friend, foe, or neutral. That's exactly what those dossiers that you're talking about are going to be utilized for. They will be able to say, yeah, this is a good guy, this is a bad guy, this guy's neither one. And that's what their chip is going to reflect once they get their chip. And who knows, maybe our chip with the Highway Patrol, with the Department of Motor Vehicles is going to be a friend, foe, or neutral chip. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing at this point. But I do know that they started utilizing these chips in the military back in the 1990s because I had a number of troops that showed me where their chip was implanted. And some of them had actually had them taken out at that time. Most of them at the time told me that they did sign a consent form, so it wasn't as if it was done without their knowledge. They did it. They were usually part of special forces. But now I don't know how much of the military or what percentage of it is being chipped, but that's part of the control. And, of course, now we have all the information coming out from the military in which the military is not allowed to own its own weapons. In other words, you cannot be a private owner of a pistol or a shotgun or anything else. You have got to tell the military that you own those weapons and where they're kept. So now we have this group, Oath Keepers, I believe it is. I think that's the name of it.
That's the name of it for having the head of that on next Monday. Go ahead.
That's excellent. And everybody tune in for that. Because these are a group of military people that are standing down and saying, no, I will not support the taking of weapons from the American public. I will not support, there's a whole list of things, and they'll tell you about it. And it's very important that we support this group and military people get behind this, because Oath Keepers is a unique organization that is now starting, and, I mean, they are right on target. They are for the sovereignty of individuals. They believe that rights come from God, not from the government. And I am very much in admiration of these people and so thrilled that they're doing what they're doing. And we don't know how many military people are going to stand down, but we are hearing from military people as well as law enforcement people that are saying, no, we will not take away the weapons. Now, do I know that we have enough people to make a difference? I wish we did. I can't say that. But I think when you look from where we began a while ago in 1990 through the progress that is made right now, there is no way anyone can deny what is taking place. Now, I don't know if you've had Sheriff Richard Mack on your program recently.
No, I haven't.
He has come out with a new book for sheriffs.
Oh, you mean Sheriff Mack? I haven't heard from him in a long time. I'm so glad he's still up there and working.
Oh, former Sheriff Richard Mack, who probably made the biggest Supreme Court decision with respect to the Second Amendment, was pretty much relieved of his job, or not reelected, let's say, after he made the stand on the Second Amendment. Sheriff Richard Mack has done a wonderful thing. You need to get in touch with him and get his book, and it is a book for county sheriffs. And in it, it's about 50 pages, I believe. It's done very, very well, very professionally. And it says, here, Mr. Sheriff, here, county sheriff, here's your responsibilities, here's what's about to happen, and if you don't take care of your county, this country's going to fail. And I had a law enforcement officer that was reading that book who literally put it down and said, I cannot touch that again. I know what he's saying is true, and I don't want to be responsible, because he said, my job is $100,000 plus per year, and I will not give up my job knowing what I know, and I don't want to know it. In other words, don't tell me this information. So we had, we asked people to purchase this booklet, and we have gotten over 800 of them out to county sheriffs. Now, I believe we start on the low level, the grassroots level, and work up. So I'm taking my sheriff one this Saturday, and I'm going to explain to him, because I happen to know where he's going to be on Saturday, explain to him that this is who I am, what I am, and I am not one of those bad guys in Missouri that belongs to a militia. Now, I would suggest that everybody look at educating your own county sheriff. This book is perfect for it. He has done a tremendous job. It's very attractive.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Go ahead and pick the story up there, Jim.
We had one woman in the state of Montana who purchased one for every county sheriff in Montana and sent them to them. We had one in Minnesota who purchased one for every county sheriff in Minnesota and sent them out. Now, this is the way we're going to do it, is start at the local level. And I don't care if they get two or three of them, let them share them around. But I want to encourage people to start educating their local county sheriff, because that's who's going to be the one to say, no, Mr. Federale, you're not coming into my county. And I know the county sheriff is extremely important where I live. He is the one that controls things around here. So people are rising up now. I was on an airplane the other day, 5.5-hour flight, and the stewardess, the flight attendant, was reading Crossing the Rubicon by Mike Rupert.
Right.
And it was amazing. And I said to her, you're reading Crossing the Rubicon? She said, I am really into what's going on right now, and my group of people that I associate with have figured out what's going on, and it's not good. So we talked for the longest time on this 5.5-hour flight. She knows all the people we know. Her husband's writing a book about the shadow government and doing a lot of real research and more recent kinds of things. And it's just amazing how many people are figuring out that we're in trouble, and the only way out of it is to educate our people.
Well, I agree with you, Joyce, and Chris, what you're doing, and certainly what many other people are doing out there across America. We have the vast majority of people value their freedom. They just got to understand that they're not going to be able to maintain their freedom unless they're involved. Freedom is never free, and those who aren't going to be willing to stand for it will certainly lose it, because the wicked people are in total working control of both political parties and make mockery of the so-called electoral process. We got about 45 seconds to wrap up the program before I let you go.
Well, I just want to encourage everybody to tune in Monday for Oath Keepers. Support that organization. Get behind the education in your local county. Don't be afraid to be the tallest nail on the board. Yeah, it might get hit first, but you know what? We have nothing to lose at this. I mean, we have everything to lose at this point. And I am going to stand and continue to stand, as I know Dr. Stan is, because we have a God that is so much more powerful than any of these people think that they are. And you know what? Our God admires and loves truth. and he does everything he can to expand that truth. And I believe that we will be protected. I mean, I don't know where my particular journey is going to go, but I don't fear anything right now. What I fear is not doing the right thing.
We're out of time, God. God bless. Bye-bye, Joyce.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I do hope you've enjoyed Joyce Riley, and Joyce is a personal friend, and I really admire her a great deal. She's a very courageous woman who's given her life to this battle. Are you willing to become involved in this battle? If you'd like to get that book, it's called Revolution in Conflict, Short of War, a Revolution in Conflict, in Military Conflict, Short of War. We actually carry that. Revolution in Military Affairs, Conflict, Short of War. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. You may be able to find it on the Internet and pull it down, but we actually have it here. It's bound, and we make it available. And we have so many other things that you need to get. I mean, we have all sorts of government reports on MK Ultra, where they were doing experiments on American servicemen and American citizens without their knowledge. There really are evil and wicked people out there, and some of them are working in the highest levels of our government. But because behind this whole thing are these powerful spiritual forces, and if you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. And if you can't afford to get it, get on the Internet and go to my website, RadioLiberty.com, and just scroll down on the videos, and you'll see the talk. And it's free. You can watch it. Actually, the book came from there. The book has the advantage because it gives you all the sources of reference, so you can check it out yourself to find there really are people out there who worship Satan. They actually are satanic worshipers, and some of them are among the most powerful people in the world today. So you need to get our material. If you haven't yet seen the DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix, going into the occult emblem on the back of the dollar bill, and everything is made to believe, make you believe that those are Christian emblems. That eye, you know, in the pyramid over the top of the unfinished pyramid. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a symbol of the ancient mystery religions, of the ancient secret societies, of the ancient Luciferian worshippers. Understand that. In fact, if you want to read a book written by the people on the other side, it's called The Secret Destiny of America, written by Manly P. Hall, and of course one of his disciples was a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That's covered in the DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix. But of course Manly P. Hall will tell you about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill. It is the emblem of the ancient mystery religions. Why is it there? Because America, they're going to use our financial and military power to bring about this world government. A one world order, and of course, a one world financial system, and destruction of Christianity. Why do you think they took God and prayer out of our schools? And why do you think they took the Ten Commandments out of our schools? Because they wanted chaos. They wanted to destroy belief in God. We can't have the Ten Commandments in our schools because the children might actually read them, and then they might obey them, and then they might stop killing one another. People talk about the increasing lawlessness. Why don't we bring religion back into our schools and the fear of God and the understanding that there are consequences for what you do? Why are we putting material in the drinking water? And I'm talking about hydrofluorosilicic acid. It's in 90% of the communities where they fluoridate the water, and it increases the lead level in the blood, especially in blacks, which is one reason why one in every three young black men between 21 and 31 are in prison, probation, or parole. One out of every 33 Americans are in prison, probation, or parole. That's what happens when you take God out of the schools, and then you poison people with a product that poisons their minds. Lead poisons their mind, and we have the material put out by a doctor back to Roger Masters back at Dartmouth University, who really his job was to study a criminal behavior, and he found in the areas with the fluoridated water where they used the hydrofluorosilicic acid, the crime level was so much higher than in the areas where they didn't. Of course, poisoned the minds of the blacks, and of course the whites too, but the lead level only doubled in whites, went up six times in the blacks. Everybody tells how terrible blacks, toys are, they toys with lead in them. Some of the children's books had lead in them, and they're not telling you. They are intentionally doing this. They know about these studies, Roger Masters studies. They just don't want you to know. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
IRN USA Radio News, I'm Hope Duggar. President Barack Obama has been on Capitol Hill pushing his $3.6 trillion budget plan. The plan has ignited a bit of a firestorm among lawmakers.